Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday night class. Tonight we have our brother John speaking on Nehemiah and the faithful. Now, to introduce John's topic, he's asked us to read Nehemiah chapter 2.
Thanks for that reading, Max. And good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out this evening.
Excellent.
Okay, Nehemiah and the faithful. Really, when we're talking about Nehemiah, it's really talking about Nehemiah going to Jerusalem and the return to Jerusalem of those who have been exiled into Babylon at the time. So we'll start off here by just having a look at some historical stuff. So here's my somewhat crude 6,000-year history timeline. We're Nehemiah and Ezra, we're really referring to this period here. So they're the last historical books of the Old Testament. And it's during this period of the Babylonian and Medo-Persian empires that they're involved with. And the period really that we're looking at, or that we're going to be looking at for Nehemiah, is in this period of around 600 BC to around 450 BC. So that's sort of in the larger picture. If we, I grabbed this out of a book. I thought it wasn't much point in trying to reproduce this, but I find this quite good in regards to the Old Testament history at a glance. Now, it's only sort of half of the Old Testament, and it's going from around 1200 BC through to around 400 BC there. So I'll just explain this chart a little bit so it makes a little bit more sense. The white line at the top here is Israel's northern neighbours, mainly Assyria and Babylon, Persia, those sorts of areas. The middle line here is Israel itself, and around this time period of 920 BC, it becomes a divided kingdom. And then the bottom line here is Israel's southern neighbours, namely Egypt. And as I say, we're predominantly looking at this middle bit here. So on the left-hand side here, there's the Exodus out of Egypt. When the Israelites come out of Egypt, they move up. Joshua takes over. There's the fall of Jericho there. We go through the period of the judges. That's what the colored periods sort of cover these. Period of the judges. Come into the monarchy where we've got Saul, King David, Solomon as well. And then we've got Israel splitting into this northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And Jerusalem is within the southern kingdom of Judah. And we're really going to be starting to look at this time period here when the Israelites are taken into captivity into Babylon. So just to make that a little bit easier, I will just zoom in on this section here a little bit there. Oh, sorry, I will just mention down the bottom here, it has got the order of the historical books of the Old Testament from Judges, Ruth, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings and Chronicles. And then finally, we've got Ezra, Esther and Nehemiah. So just zooming in on that section, so it's a little bit easier for people to see, we'll start to have a look at this. So from around, specifically we're looking at, from 720 BC, the northern part of Israel is taken into captivity by the Assyrians, and it doesn't exist anymore after that time period. The southern part, Judah, it's up until around 610. We then see Daniel taken to Babylon, taken into captivity. Then about 20 years later, around 590 BC, is the first batch of captives that are taken into exile. And probably about another 10 or so years later is the second batch of captives that are taken into exile to Babylon. And it's around this time that Jerusalem falls to Nebuchadnezzar II, and Jerusalem is destroyed. And when we say destroyed, we mean it's destroyed. The walls are broken down, the houses are smashed, the temple is in ruins, the place is just trashed, and they're all taken. The majority of them are taken captive to Babylon. There is a remnant of them that stay in Jerusalem, and not much really happens with them at that time. Then 70 years later from when they're first taken into captivity to Babylon, 70 years later, Zerubbabel and the main party of exiles return. So they're led by Zerubbabel, who is appointed the governor at the time, and Joshua is appointed the high priest. And around this time, there's about 50,000 people that return to Jerusalem. And their main purpose for returning at that time is the reconstruction of the temple. Then, probably about 70 or 80 years later, Ezra returns from exile with some people. And the purpose of Ezra's return, so Ezra's the priest, he returns with his purpose of having to furnish the temple. So he's taking all of the various bits of furniture back to put them into the temple and to try and reestablish some of the other customs and parts of the law. They do establish some of the feasts and so forth from when they from the second temple completion as well. But there's still not a lot going on in Jerusalem. A few years later, Nehemiah returns to Jerusalem, and Nehemiah returns specifically to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And eventually he does work on re-establishing the law in Jerusalem and the various other feasts and so forth going forward. There are actually three decrees that are written by the various kings at the time within Medo-Persia in regards to the return and the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And we've got these on the next one. So the first decree comes in Ezra chapter 1, verse 2, where it reads, "Thus says Cyrus, the king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah." That's around 539 BC. The second decree comes also in. So that first decree is when Zerubbabel and Joshua go back. Ezra's not involved in that, although Ezra records it. Ezra chapter 7, verse 6 is when the second decree comes out, and it reads, "You know, the king granted him all his request according to the hand of the Lord his God." Now, this is the copy of the letter that the king Artaxerxes gave unto Ezra the priest. "I, Artaxerxes the king, do make a decree to all the treasures which are beyond the river, and that he can then take them back and take all those treasures back to Jerusalem and re-establish the furniture back in the temple." That's around 458 BC. Now, there is a little bit of debate around some of these dates. We're happy to talk to people afterwards about it, but we won't go into them during this particular study. It's not the important part of this study. And then the final decree is in Nehemiah chapter 2, and we read that this evening. Nehemiah 2 verse 1 says, "And it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king." And then further on in verse 7 and 8, where it says, "Moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given to me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come into Judah. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace." So that was one of the things that he's going back to fix, which appertain to the house, "and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me." Note that Nehemiah says that it wasn't just the king's choice, that it was by the good hand of God that these things occurred. And that's around 450 BC. Now, it doesn't, Nehemiah just doesn't go to the king and ask for this, and it doesn't happen, you know, really quite easily. And the king just didn't say to Nehemiah, "Oh, yep, look, off you go. You know, you need to go to Jerusalem and do some work over there." What prompts Nehemiah to do this? So just turn back a chapter and we'll have a look at Nehemiah chapter 1. And, look, we'll read the first three verses there. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, and it came to pass in the month of Chislu, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the palace, that Hananiah, one of my brethren, came, he and certain men of Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. So the first question that Nehemiah asks his brethren is, how are the others back in Jerusalem? What's the city like? What's the temple like? This sort of thing. His heart is still back there in Jerusalem. And then if we have a quick look in verse 4, and it came to pass when I heard these words in regards to the fact that it was all still broken down and the walls were with fire, when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned many days. So it really affects Nehemiah. And through the rest of chapter 1, we can read, for 4 months, Nehemiah anguishes over this as to what to do. And this is the first of his big challenges, because he wants to go back to Jerusalem, but he can't just sort of walk away from his job. So before we get into it, so over this period when Nehemiah does return, there's 5 challenges that Nehemiah encounters. The first one is around, how can Nehemiah get leave to go to Jerusalem? Then there is the need, once he's there, to enthuse the dejected and disinterested people into getting them to rebuild the walls. There's dealing with ridicule from enemies, because people obviously didn't want it to be rebuilt. Overcoming pessimism due to oppression and the hard work. After a while, people start going, oh, this is a fair bit of work, Nehemiah, and we're still getting harassed. We've kind of had enough of this. And then dealing with subtlety and falsehood, where some of the enemies try to deceive Nehemiah to get him to stop the rebuilding work. Now, during the rebuilding of the temple, which is led by Zerubbabel and Joshua, there are others living around Jerusalem at the time who don't want the building work to happen. And they send report to King Artaxerxes at the time, suggesting that the rebuilding of the temple is an uprising and a rebellion. And Nehemiah is, as a result of this, the king puts a stop to the rebuilding of the temple. So it takes quite a while for the temple to be rebuilt. Nehemiah is understandably nervous about asking his boss, the king, who had previously put a stop to the rebuilding work in Jerusalem, he's nervous about asking his boss to take leave and go to Jerusalem. And you can kind of understand that. He's the king's cupbearer. So, first question for the young ones at the front here before we go to the oldies. What are the 2 main functions of a cupbearer?
Taste the wine.
Taste the wine. That's one of the functions. Why would he need to taste the wine?
Poisoned.
See if it's poisoned. Exactly right. The other main role, not the main function of a cupbearer? To bear the cup, exactly. To simply take the drink to the king, but before he gives it to the king, as Max correctly pointed out, he tastes the wine to make sure that no one's trying to poison the king. Right? It's a pretty important job, really, certainly from the king's point of view. It's not a job that's easily walked away from. Remember, Nehemiah is a servant. He's still a slave. He doesn't have the freedoms to just walk away from his job. And so you can understand why he's nervous about going to his boss, the king, and saying, I'd like to take some time off to go back to Jerusalem to help them rebuild the city that you recently made a decree to stop rebuilding. Now, the fact that Nehemiah wants to go back to Jerusalem, this is an indication of his character. Because let's be honest, he was actually pretty comfortable and well off with where he was in the palace of Shushan in Persia. And this in itself is a lesson for us. So he still wants to go back to Jerusalem. He wants to re-establish Jerusalem and the temple there. And the lesson for us is that we can get comfortable in our lives and not want to put ourselves out for other people or to put ourselves out for the work of God. But it really affected Nehemiah, hearing that the city was still broken down. And as we read earlier in verse 4, he wept and mourned certain days and he fasted. And most importantly, he prays to God and asks for help. Once again, a lesson for us. When there's things that we're not sure about, some situation in our lives, some event that we're not sure about, first we need to seek God's guidance. Did Nehemiah get an answer straight away? No, he didn't. It took 4 months before he had an opportunity with the king. And finally, this opportunity arises with the king. And this is sort of one of these are you okay moments. In the reading that we had there, at the end of verse 1, he says, "I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence. And so the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad?" And as I say, this is sort of like a bit of an are you okay moment. The king said to Nehemiah, "Nehemiah, are you okay? You don't seem quite right." And that's something to think about. Because one, we should be looking out for each other to ask each other whether we're okay, because we all have stresses and trials in our lives. But it is also an opportunity that if someone asks us, particularly someone outside of our faith, asks us if we're okay, that this is an opportunity that we can take to, one, as I say, check in on the welfare of somebody else, or it's an opportunity to share our faith with somebody else as well. So Nehemiah takes this opportunity to explain to the king as to why he's feeling sad. And we read earlier, the king grants him leave with letters of decrees, which we've already had a look at there. So Nehemiah then takes his journey and heads off to Jerusalem. And when he gets there, he has to motivate the people, which we read about also in the reading there. There's this need to actually enthuse the dejected and disinterested or disheartened people because they've tried to rebuild the city and the temple and suddenly they've been told to stop all work. Nehemiah doesn't go there sort of guns blazing and all high and mighty on his pedestal, you know, waving the king's decree around going, "Hey, everybody, I've got this decree from the king. Come on, let's go start, you know, rebuilding the walls." When he first goes there, he's fairly quiet about it. He becomes one of the people. If we just reread have a look at verses 11 and 12. "So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days, and I arose in the night, I and some few men with me. Neither told I any man what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. Neither was there any beast with me save the beast that I rode upon." So he quietly blends in. He assesses the situation, and we read the verses there where he goes off and he sees parts of the wall that are broken down, and they tell us, you know, what he sees and how he feels. Then note in verse 16, "And the rulers knew not whither I went or what I did, neither had I as yet told it to the Jews nor to the priests, nor to the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor to the rest that did the work. So he hasn't said anything to anybody. And as I say, he blends in. At verse 17, then said I unto them, ye see the distress that we are in. He doesn't go there to say, I can see the problem that you've got here. No, he blends in. He becomes one of them. He is one of them. And he says, you can see the distress that we are in. He starts to lead from within. And he appeals to their sense of self-worth. He says, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem that we be no more a reproach. In other words, that we're no longer ashamed of where we live, that we're not put to shame or we're not disgraced in any way. Other versions have disapproval or disappointment as well. Once again, he motivates from within first. And Nehemiah's enthusiasm then starts to inspire the people. If we read the rest of verse 18 there, then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also the king's words that he had spoken unto, And they said, let us rise up and build. And so they strengthened their hands for this good work. Let us rise up and build. So clearly he's starting to motivate them. And as I say, he's not there to just tell them what to do. He's there to get involved as well. Now, once they start to rebuild, they do encounter some resistance. So before we sort of dive into the resistance they encounter, have a quick look at chapter 3. And chapter 3 is the, we won't go into too much detail, but chapter 3 is the book on who built what. And it goes through the various different family names and what they were involved in building. Now, thankfully, people have done the work before us, so this is all quite easy to then look at. Here's a breakdown of all of the verses, the different family names, and then what section of the wall each of them, it's readable, what section of the wall each of them worked on. We can see here immediately, verse 16, there's Nehemiah mentioned, and he was involved in working on the wall against the sepulchres of David, to the pool and unto the house of the mighty. Interestingly enough, all of the verses and the sections of the wall that the different families are involved in rebuilding are in order around the city. So if we start up in verse 1, Elishab the high priest and his brethren, they work on the sheep gate and unto the tower of Mehar and the tower of Hananeel. And then afterwards, we've got the men of Jericho and Zakur. They work between the tower of Hananeel and the fish gate and so forth. And it works its way all the way around until we get right down to verse 32, where it's the goldsmiths and the merchants. And they work from the corner unto the sheep gate, which is where we started, at the sheep gate. So that's just something interesting. Yeah, chapter 3 covers all of that aspect from it. And I was pleased to find in one of the senior Sunday school note books is they actually have a diagram of the old city and where each of the families were involved. And we can start up the top here. The gates are numbered 1 around through to 12. And there we have the sheep gate. And there's Elishab and the priests, and they build the wall from the sheep gate to the tower of Mehar, then the tower of Hananeel, where the men of Jericho and Zakur work on. Then we've got, and they cover part of the wall there as well. And we've got the fish gate, which is the sons of Hasaniah. And then the next section of wall and so forth. And we can work our way around there. Interesting enough, some families work on a couple of sections of the wall as well. So sometimes you'll see a family name there twice. Interestingly enough, the largest section is Shalom and his daughters. So everybody got involved. It wasn't just the men. All the family members got involved. He must have had a lot of daughters because that's quite a large section of a wall. Maybe that was it, yes.
It was all the boyfriends hanging around.
That is true. Okay. The other thing just to note, and we'll just come back to this one, Nehemiah is quite astute because often it's recorded that, so like here, Benjamin, Ahishab, and Azariah, they work on the wall against their houses. So as I say, Nehemiah is fairly astute in that he allocates people a section of wall that's right next to their house because people are going to be far more interested in rebuilding the section of wall that's protecting their house rather than a section of wall on the other side of the city. So once again, as I say, he's fairly wise and astute and gets people involved. Yeah, it's not always plain sailing, and he has to deal with some ridicule along the way. Certainly the excitement of the Israelites starting to rebuild the walls, it tended to bring a fairly unfavourable reaction from some of the other people around about, some of the local enemies. And it starts in verse 10, which we read earlier. So let's just have a quick look at that. When Nehemiah is travelling to Jerusalem, in verse 10, when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, heard of it, that Nehemiah was coming, it grieved them exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. You know, they're kind of going, what is this guy doing? What's he coming in? Look for this, you know, to help these Israelites. It grieved them exceedingly. Yeah, they must have gone, yeah, what's this all about? Now, that's just the beginning of some of the negativity and ridicule that he encounters. It goes on further if we have a look at verse 19. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that you do? Will you rebel against the king? And so they're trying to call them out and saying, what are you rebuilding the city for? Don't you know there's a decree from King Artaxerxes that said you're not allowed to build? So you know, they're starting to encounter some resistance here. I think at different times we will all personally experience some form of ridicule and shame in our lives because of our faith and because of what we believe. Nehemiah was astute and aware that this would happen, and he had a ready answer, and it's something that we should think about in our own lives when we might find ourselves in a situation where we could encounter some ridicule. If we just have a look at verse 20, when Nehemiah answers, he says, then answered I them and said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. But ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem. We're reminded of the words in 1 Peter. Well, as I say, it's always wise to have a ready answer for situations. So we're reminded of these words in 1 Peter 3:15. Be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and with fear. And sometimes a simple, succinct statement is all that's required to silence people. Here Nehemiah simply just said to them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. And as I say, sometimes a succinct statement like that is all that's needed. Something on the lines of, I believe God has a plan and he has asked me to do these things in his service. And so this is the way that I'm going to live my life. And you're really what we're doing, or what Nehemiah's doing here, and what we can do in our own lives, is we're demonstrating that our actions are in line with our beliefs and our faith. And sometimes that's all that's needed. The next challenge that Nehemiah has is to overcome the pessimism that's going on there, and their oppression and resistance to hard work. None of us can maintain a thick skin all of our lives. And when we continually face ridicule and so forth, that ridicule will eventually cut into our faith. And that's why it's important that we, as a family, come together around the Word of God regularly to help renew our faith and to help strengthen each other. That was not the last that Nehemiah would hear from Sanballat and Tobiah. And once the wall starts to be built, the enemies are back harassing them. Come across to chapter 4. So the whole of chapter 3 is all about who builds what. And then we get into chapter 4. And I'll just read the first three verses there. But it came to pass that when Sanballat heard that we builded the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation and mocked the Jews. And he spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, What do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end of a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of the rubbish which are burned? Now Tobiah the Ammonite was by him, and he said, Even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break it down, their stone wall. And so they're really ridiculing them here, aren't they? They're going, your walls are so weak, you Israelites. Even if a fox came along and jumped on them, they'd fall down again. You know, what's the point of rebuilding them? So they're constantly being harassed by these people around them. So you can understand why there's a bit of pessimism going on. Once again, Nehemiah takes them to God in prayer. And verses 4 and 5 tell us about that. Verse 4, Hear, O God, for we are despised. And so they pray to God again. And that's something that we must remind ourselves of as well. When things do get a little bit tough at times, it is worth going to God in prayer, sometimes with somebody else as a group. And that can help encourage us. And it does for the Israelites. In verse 6, So build we the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto the half thereof, for the people had a mind to work. And so they've really got their minds focused on it. It wasn't just the prayer that they had, but they then went and did something with it. And we see this time and again here with Nehemiah. They'll go to God, and then there's an action that comes afterwards. And verses 7 and 8, they actually set a watch as well, because there's some other threats that come along. If we have a look at verse 12, And it came to pass that when the Jews which dwelt by them, against these people who were enemies of them, they said unto us 10 times, From all places whence ye return unto us, they will be upon you. They've been harassed over and over and over again, saying every time you come to us, you're going to get attacked. Your walls aren't going to save you. Right? So they've been once again ridiculed again. And if we were in that position, let's say every day for 10 days. Somebody gives you a hard time about your faith and about the work that you're doing in the Lord, you're going to start to feel a bit uneasy about that, and that's going to start to hurt. Pessimism comes from within. Even though people might say things to us, and it hurts us, when we start to get pessimistic, that's coming from within us, right? We're letting somebody else's words affect us in some way. And I'm not saying it's just a matter of just having tough skin and getting over it. It's not. Right? We do need to often get help as well. And what happens here, we'll just read through verses 14 to 16. And I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles and to the rulers and to the rest of the people, be not ye afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. And it came to pass, when our enemies heard that it was known unto us, and God had brought their counsel to naught, that we returned all of us to the wall, every one unto his work. And it came to pass from that time forth that the half of my servants wrought in the work, and the other half of them held both the spears, the shields, and the bows, and the harbingers, and the rulers were behind all the house of Judah. They didn't have to be involved in direct conflict or hand-to-hand combat. They simply set a guard, and this was enough to put those people off. He essentially tells them to put on the armour of God, and this reminds us of the Apostle Paul's writings in Ephesians chapter 6, where it reads about, you know, putting on the whole armour of God, loins girt with truth, breastplate of righteousness, the gospel of peace, the shield of faith, helmet of salvation, sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, watching for all saints, in other words, looking out for each other, boldly make known the gospel, preaching the gospel, and having done all that we might stand. Thankfully today we don't have to get involved in hand-to-hand combat, holding literal spears and shields and so forth, but it's this spiritual war that we must take on, and the spiritual arms that we have to take on to set a guard. The Apostle Paul goes on and says that we don't fight against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, and against the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness, so to speak. Subtlety and falsehood came Nehemiah's way next. Sanballat and Tobiah weren't finished. Right? Come across to chapter 6. Chapter 6, and we'll read verses 1 to 4. Now it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, the Arabian, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me mischief. And I sent messages unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease whilst I leave it and come down to you? Yet they sent unto me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. The enemies had tried to bring the work to a standstill. They first tried by ridicule, intimidation, and threats of violence, and failing this, they start to try more cunning things, like this, when they call Nehemiah away. They seek a conference with Nehemiah, but their real intention was clearly to just harm him. If they could, they knew that Nehemiah was sort of like the mainstay, the leader behind all of the work, and if they could knock him off, they thought that the work of rebuilding Jerusalem would stop. But Nehemiah perceives their sinister objectives against him, and he gives the classic answer, I'm doing a great work for God, and so I cannot come. Why should I stop working for God while I leave it and then come just to see you? And he gives this same answer all four times that they come back to him. Well, Sanballat then tries again a fifth time in verse 6, where he says, Nehemiah, there's this rumor amongst the heathen that you Jews are rebelling, and that you, Nehemiah, you want to be the king. You'd better come and sort it out, Nehemiah. So he's sort of made up this story about it. Verse 8, Nehemiah replies to him and says, look, there's no such thing. You've just made it up. And so ignores him during that time. Then in verses 10 to 12, they try to discredit Nehemiah. So they try to trick him to go and lock himself in the temple at the time, so that people will get the idea that Nehemiah's fearful of the invaders, and that will sort of discredit him. And then they can say, oh, Nehemiah doesn't trust in God. Yeah, there's no point doing this rebuilding work. And so they're trying to be quite subtle in the way that they're trying to deceive Nehemiah. Nehemiah was obviously quite perceptive of the events around him. And likewise, it is important for us to be aware of the events in the world around us and how these events can subtly try to divert us away from the work of God and from our own faith. Later on, Jesus' words in Matthew 10, verse 16, where he says, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves." Probably got enough time. I'll cover this. So I want to bring this particular thing very much into our day and age now. There's two things I really want to draw your attention to. The first one is, and I say this to young people and old people alike, be careful of the online forums that you are involved in. Likes, subscribes, comments, right? It is so easy nowadays for someone to use some form of an online AI engine to troll your online profile, to get a nice little summary about your online activity in regards to, as I say, likes, subscribes, comments, and so forth. They can analyze your behavior and your thinking. So we do need to be very careful about it and think about, do my actions in this online environment line up with the sentiment of, say, the online preaching that we're trying to do as an ecclesia? Many of us have been involved in doing some of that online preaching as well. Think about some of your other online forums, as I say, likes, subscribes, comments and follows and this sort of thing, as to whether they might line up. Because people can very easily pull information out about your online profile, identify that you are a Christadelphian, and then go across to online preaching activities and use information from other profiles to discredit the work of preaching the word in the online environment. I think it's quite important that we do have an online preaching environment, because that's where a lot of people are trying to look for, you know, that's where people do go looking for answers nowadays to find the truth. This was the situation with Nehemiah that he was in as well. They were trying to pull him away from doing the work of God by trying to discredit him to stop this work going on. And so we face the same online sense in online forums and so forth. We can be drawn into making comments that are contrary to our beliefs and other work that's going on for God. Also to note that most employers will also do a online reference check. They will usually go to another online company and say, tell us everything about this person, this individual. And they'll go on, yep, run some AI engines and pull out everything about what you've ever done online. And then your employers will have a look at that and go, will we want to employ this person or not? So that's one thing. Be careful about our online forums. The second point that I want to make, and I'm assuming that most people here will have heard of the unfortunate assassination of the right-wing American activist, Charlie Kirk. Sort of nods, most nods around the hall. Okay, that's good. First thing I'll say up front is no one should be assassinated for expressing their religious or political views. It's quite unfortunate. What is concerning is that ever since this assassination, the commentary that is coming out, both online, political, through the news media and so forth, is creating a polarizing division within America and around the world. Instead of trying to sort of bring people together because of this situation, we're seeing what can really only be characterized as vitriol, and if you're not sure about that, that means sort of bitter criticism and malice against your opposition in various communities. To put it in another words, it's sort of like, hey, if you don't agree with our conservative Christian values and our political ideas, then you're the problem. That's the way it's been put out within the media and around and online forums. You might say, oh, look, John, American politics has always been a bit like that. Right? We can leave them to it. We can comfortably sit here in Australia. We don't have to worry about it. And I'll put to you that that's a little bit like Nehemiah sitting in the palace of Shushan in Persia and saying, I can see there's problems with Jerusalem over there. They've got some real issues. But I'm in the palace of Shushan. I'm pretty comfortable here. I might just stay here. It's a little bit like that. Now, I'm not suggesting that we need to go to America and try and take on their political system in any way. We don't have to, because it's coming here, whether we like it or not. So I'll ask the question. Anybody here heard of Turning Point Australia? A few people have. Turning Point Australia? Okay. Turning Point Australia, you can go and look it up afterwards. Anyway, Turning Point Australia is actually the Australian affiliate of Turning Point USA. Turning Point USA is the right-wing activist group that Mr. Kirk belonged to. Early next year, there is the South Australian election in March 2026. Turning Point Australia now have a Senate or state leader in South Australia, and they plan to target South Australia with a number of events to promote their party, including promotions at university campuses similar to the American style. All right, so who's going to uni here? Yeah. Have you heard of Turning Point Australia at uni as yet? Yes and no, maybe, yeah. So you can expect to hear more about it in South Australia at universities and so forth. It's coming. And we might say, wow, look, hey, you know, we don't vote. It's okay. We just say we don't vote. Don't need to get involved. But someone could get online and view your likes, subscribes, and shares and say, hey, you agreed with this or you disagreed with that online. Why don't you vote? You're going to make a comment about things online. Surely you should get involved in the politics in the country. Don't you want to see conservative Christian values being adopted by our political leaders more? And this is the sort of commentary that will come out. It's subtle. The current Turning Point Australia group, they currently have around 300,000 followers on Facebook. And to be honest, 300,000 followers isn't much in the grand scheme of things, but it's growing quite rapidly, right? And I'm sure over the next couple of months it will grow considerably more. Some commentators are saying, hey, look, Turning Point Australia, they're actually out of step with mainstream Australians, and that most Australians won't warm to their style of politics. But we don't know. Who knows? We'll have to see how that goes. The reason I mention it is, one, because, yeah, our online commentary can have an involvement with that. And the risk here is that fundamental Christian ideals, which we like to feel that we have, you know, good fundamental Christian ideals, these are being used as a catalyst for political motives and for other people's personal gains in the political spheres. Right? So it's a couple of points there just to be aware of that these things are coming at us. They are subtle as they come to us. And we, as I say, need to be careful about what we're doing online. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying don't be online at all. Hey, I'm online. You almost can't exist nowadays without having some form of an online presence. And we just need to be a little bit careful about it. Okay, let's move on. Go back to Nehemiah and rebuilding of the wall. And the wall is complete. So let's have a look at chapter 6 and verses 15 and 16. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. And it came to pass when all our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of God. Despite all attempts to the contrary, the work was completed in rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And there's this note of triumph in the words there as well, wasn't it? That they'd finally finished it in the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. That's quite astounding when you think about the walls of Jerusalem being rebuilt in 52 days. Keep in mind what I said to begin with, when they first started going back, that there was a group of 50,000 people that went back. So there were multiple thousands of people who were involved in rebuilding of the walls. Even still, to do it in 52 days is quite a feat. It's quite remarkable. So it is quite clear that it was God's blessing upon them. And it was really the work of God in regards to rebuilding the walls. And interesting how those verses read, isn't it? That even those people who were against them acknowledged the fact that this must have been wrought of God, yeah, that God must have helped them because it was quite a remarkable achievement within such a short amount of time. I came across this verse here from the Psalms that says, "Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all." We've sort of run out of time this evening, so we'll have to wrap it up there. I probably need to apologise to Sebastian. Actually, when he first asked me about this, I went, "Oh yeah, one night should be enough." And really, we've only sort of covered the first half of the book of Nehemiah. So I'll just give a bit of a summary here and some other comments. Nehemiah was sincere when he desired to return to Judah and Jerusalem. And so God answered his prayer. And the sincere, honest prayers of us will be answered by God. He will answer them. Nehemiah was a great leader because he didn't give up in the face of problems or adversities. He instead sought God out. He personally got involved in the work with the people. He was a man of prayer and he took action. Once again, it's that thing about faith and works. Go to God in prayer, ask for guidance and direction, but then go and take action. Don't just sit there doing nothing. The enthusiasm and pessimism are contagious. We can only inspire people to do the work of God if we are dedicated and passionate ourselves. And obviously we need to be careful about our own pessimistic words at any times because that can be contagious. Nehemiah was a man of quick perception, and likewise, there is a need for us to be aware of the things in the world around us and to reject the subtle philosophies that are coming our way in the world in these last days. And so, as I said before, we really only got through the first half of the book here. There was great faith by Zerubbabel as well, and Joshua and Ezra for leading the early groups to return. And I'll just quickly sort of draw your attention to some of the other chapters here. Just take a moment. Chapter 7 lists the families who returned and their numbers, and it tells us the numbers. So it goes through each of the families and tells us how many returned with each of the families. Verses 66 and 67 tell us the total numbers, and they add up to about 50,000 people. Chapters 8 to 10 is when they re-establish the law. Ezra comes back to read the law out and get people involved in more of the feasts. They make a covenant to abide by the law. And chapter 10 lists all of the families who are in agreement with the covenant as well. And I just want to finish with verse 28. Which is just after the list of all of the families that agree to the covenant. Verse 28, "And the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the porters, the singers, the Nethinims, and all they that separate themselves from the people of the lands unto the law of God, their wives, their sons, and their daughters, everyone having knowledge and having understanding." And I think that's quite relevant for us because it's about, I mean, you know, we separate ourselves from the things in the world around us. And it's about knowledge, having knowledge and an understanding of God at the moment. Thanks.